Hi, it's Edward. This is the episode that we had originally planned to air 2 weeks ago, but we put on hold. And we put it on hold because there was an important security release in Git, and we were able to bring in Etienne Stallmans, the researcher who found that vulnerability. I thought about recording another special episode since, you might have heard, Microsoft has agreed to acquire GitHub. But to be honest, I'm not sure that Martin and I are the right people to address this topic. There's been a lot of announcements both from Microsoft and from GitHub on the news. Satya Nadella, Microsoft's CEO, had a great blog post. So did GitHub's current CEO, Chris Wanstrath, aka defunct. And so did Nat Friedman, who will take over as CEO when the acquisition is final. He had a great blog post, and he did a really insightful Ask Me Anything on Reddit. And I'm super excited that I'll get to work with my old coworkers at GitHub again, but I don't think you want to listen to a podcast full of me just being excited. I mean, if that's really what you're into, then that's cool. Just load up that GIF of Jonah Hill being really excited and watch that for 30 minutes. That's pretty much how I feel right now. But until we can really do the Microsoft and GitHub acquisition justice, we're going to go back to our regularly scheduled programming. So here we go, an episode of All Things Git about branching and merging. This is All Things Git, the podcast about Git. I'm Edward Thompson.
And I'm Martin Woodward. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Martin.
How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Yeah, good. I'm looking forward to this topic today, so let's get cracking.
Yeah, me too, because today we're talking about something near and dear to my heart, which is branching.
Yay.
Branching is at the heart of Git, right?
Indeed. Well, it's one of the things that make it easy anyway, so... So is it worth,
that's right,
like, first of all, starting off with a dummy's guide to what branching and then merging is?
I think that's great.
So yeah, go on. Explain
Hold on. Before we get started, we've got viewer mail.
Woohoo! We have viewers? We're listeners now?
We have viewers. Oh, yeah, I know, right? Mm-hmm. So we actually got, I got a lot of feedback about episode number 12.
Is that the with Joe Nash?
Which was Joe Nash.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I got a lot of feedback from educators. Oh. So if we go back, Joe said that he'd been told by a college instructor, that they sort of intentionally engineered the groups on group projects to have a mix of abilities in order to sort of, I don't know, socially engineer the group experience so that people had to learn conflict resolution. Mm. And, hold on here. I can play a little clip of what he said.
That first one's an interesting one, that whole like concept that universities use group projects as kind of the setting of an awful social experiment. From what I've always got from lecturers, that's like very intentional for them. They almost want to put students through the worst possible group experience they can have as a lesson in conflict management.
So I heard a lot about this feedback. So in particular, here's one email. This is Roger Light. He's in the EEE department at University of Nottingham.
Woo!
University of Nottingham is actually where Joe Nash went to school, and you have a Nottingham connection as well, right?
I do. That's where I was born, indeed. Yep.
Ah, awesome. My bicycle was made in Nottingham.
Have you got a Raleigh?
I do. I moved to Britain and bought a British bike.
Yeah, good man. We call them a Raleigh over here, by the way. I just thought I'd pronounce it in American for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. but anyway, so Roger really took issue with what Joe said. Here's what he wrote. We'd be happiest if all groups collaborated successfully with each group member contributing appropriately. The unfortunate situation is that that doesn't often happen, but it's not a situation that we would want to engineer. And I actually heard that more than just a few times. So I don't doubt that somebody's tried to engineer groups in a certain way and told Joe about that. But at least among our listeners, that's not at all common.
Yeah, it strikes me as too hard as well, you know, when you're doing these group assignments, it's often like out of the hat kind of thing, or just, you know, try and get them organized. It sounds like one of these conspiracy theories that's a good idea, but nobody in reality, nobody's actually that organized to be able to pull that kind of thing off. So I know I'm not.
Right. Right. And, you know, you'd be playing this guessing game anyway, because I think, as you said in that episode, past performance is not an indication of future gains, as they say on the infomercials.
Well, it's not, especially in project work. I think it would be fair to say that many of my physics professors assumed I was an absolute idiot, you know, and they wouldn't have been far wrong, especially when it came to physics. But when it was project work and things, that's what I can do is project work, because I didn't mind putting the hours in and putting the graft in and working, you know, and working from the beginning to the end of the project rather than trying to slam it all in the last day. That's just how I work, but I was terrible at exams, and I never turned up to lectures also. So that's also why they didn't hate me. That's also why they probably thought I'd be terrible. So, right. I know my project work, I guess they might have been surprised by how things turned out, but you know, it's just impossible to tell, isn't it? So did Roger say what they did, or did you hear from any of your other educators what they do? Is it just random selection usually, or what do they?
Yeah. Or maybe self-organizing groups. But yeah, no, I mean, they're not trying to engineer sort of some strange bell curve into the system. Nobody reached out and said that. Yeah.
So if you are an educator that is Machiavellian in that way, then do write to us and let us know. Where should they write to us, Ed?
Well, they can hit us up on Twitter or on Facebook. We're at All Things Git. And so I'll send some stickers out to Roger. And if you reach out, we can send some stickers out to you as well. Your laptop looks a lot better with an All Things Git sticker, I can assure you.
It certainly does. I've been seeing more and more of them pop up, actually. It's quite frightening.
That's bizarre.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's get on with the show. Let's talk about branching.
Let's talk about branching.
So I went for many years of my career in software development with never having to branch at all. Just always working in main or trunk or whatever we used to call it, in teams of, say, you know, five or six people. And this was in a very much a centralized version control tool. And then my first introduction to branching was not a happy one. It was doing a flight selling system for British Airways, actually. And we're working on, you know, BritishAirways.com, BA.com, the website. And there was, you know, different parts of the main application. You had like the, you know, the bit for selling flights, and then you have the bit for sticking on car hire and hotels and things to the side, you know, and then online check-in and all that sort of stuff. And all this functionality was delivered by multiple teams into the one web app. And the way that it worked for us is we would take a fork from main. It was at the time. I'm trying to remember what version control tool it was. I can't even remember. We would take a fork in our centralized version control tool, which was using like a paths-based branching mechanism. So, okay. So a lot of the way that centralized version control tools work, apart from maybe ClearCase, when you take a branch, you're actually copying part of the file system over to another part of the file system, you know, like a folder structure. So you would copy WAC source or WAC project name, WAC main or something like that into WAC project name, WAC branches, WAC feature branch name. Yeah.
Okay.
And you'd see them all within the same folder structure. You'd see all your paths within the same folder structure in the repository. Take a copy over, and we took that copy over, and then we went and did our, you know, 6 month like project to go build. I think we were adding hotel sales into the flight selling system back then. Went and added hotel sales, and then got it working, and we're happy with it in our little branch. And then we had the process of taking that branch and making it merge back into master or into main. And so we'd been working for 6 months in our little world, getting everything working. Meanwhile, the website had been going on for 6 months, you know, shipping bug fixes and things, and other teams had come in and added, say, car hire sales, or, you know, added a different part of the selling process into the website. And so when we came 6 months later to merge back into main, it was just a nightmare. It took us weeks and weeks to get that merge to work, because we'd built up merge debt. We'd not continuously integrated with what the current production website was, and so we had to. Well, it was great while we were working, because we could just go work on our own and nobody broke us. When it came to merging back into master, we had lots of trouble, and that is commonly known in the industry as merge hell, and I've lived it.
Right, right. I've also heard it called a merge bomb.
Merge bomb, which, there you go. That's a perfect description. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, my buddy Ben, you know Ben Day. Ben says that branching is an integration credit card. And there the you longer go. You wait to pay it off, the worse it's going to get, right? You're accumulating a lot of debt. And I think that's very true. And so the great thing about Git is that it encourages you to branch often and then merge often as a result.
Because that's what we would do is to try and alleviate some of that pain. In the old days, you would take frequent merges in from the main branch you're going to be merging back to later. You would take frequent drops of code from that, and you're trying to pay, you know, you're paying down the debt fairly regularly. Right. But you would probably only do that, say, once a week or once every couple of weeks. So it was still painful because you've built up merge debt. And then but you would try and pay it down in installments rather than paying it down at the very end of the end of it. And we used to in Microsoft we used to call that like reverse integrating and forward integrating, RINFI. That was, you know,
that's right. When I joined Microsoft, which was, you know, the same time you joined Microsoft, of course, so, you know, we had this crazy branching structure for our team. You know, we lived in the same repository as Visual Studio, building Visual Studio Team Services. So that repository had VS the IDE and Visual Studio Team Services the cloud software development hosting platform. And so since we shipped at the same time, we lived in the same repository. So we each took a branch off of the main repository. And then like each team took a branch off of the VSTS branch. And then from there, you might have a feature branch on top of that. So there was this crazy branching structure. And so to do that reverse integration where you wanted to bring main into your branch so that you weren't way far behind as far as that integration debt went, you'd schedule this path of integrations where you merged main up to the VSTS branch, up to your team's branch, up to your feature branch, and then merged back down. It was terrible.
It was a lot of work.
It was a lot of work. And we literally employed somebody to do this. You know, his name was Lawrence, and I can't imagine that he enjoyed that, right? Like, that sounds
certainly not a job. Yeah, and people were volunteering for, is it? And right. I know when I went over to the Windows team to go and have a look how they work for the first time, it was just, I just remember being so confused because I was sat in the back of a ship room meeting. So we have these big meetings in Microsoft where they're trying to get something out the door and they call it a ship room. And I sat in the back of one of those meetings and I was sort of listening in, you know, trying to figure out the process. And this was the Windows phone team I was with. And they were trying to get a feature, but it needed to be in the kernel, and they needed the feature in the kernel before they could then build some UX on top of it. You know, some UI on top of it. And it took around about 9 months for the feature to go from when they got it into the kernel for it to go all the way through the process and go through all the branches down and then come all the way back up again to where they were in, like, where they shipped from.
Months.
Windows Phone.
Months.
Yeah,
that's
insane. I mean, it might have got down to like 16 weeks or something, or down to 9 weeks, but I remember it being literally months to get code to flow through this thing because of all these different steps, you know, we called it ladder merging, you know. It was they had to go from the child branch to the parent branch and then up to the parent branch and so on and so forth, and those integrations only happened every now and then, and then back down and back up again.
Right that's a thing that I see a lot in centralized version control systems, or maybe used to see a lot, people who are doing legacy
with big teams.
Everybody would like sort of branch based on the corporate hierarchy. So it's really weird. So, you know, that team, you know, there's the kernel team over here, and then there's the phone team over here doing the UI on top. And like, they're very far away from each other when it comes to the branching structure, the version control layout. It's not ideal. And code flow is sometimes hampered by that.
So is that a factor of the way that centralized version control systems work? Because in a centralized version control system, or in, let's say, non-Git, you know, not in Git, it's all path-based. It's all path-based branching. So you're within the repository. You see all the branches, and when you branch and when you merge, it's a specific type of operation to that centralized version control tool. And so you have to merge back to the branch you came from always, because that's, you know, if you try and go anywhere that's not direct parent to child, then you end up in pain, basically, because the source control system isn't able to help you do the merger much anymore.
Right. So that's true of TFVC for sure. TFVC, okay. you have to merge either from a parent to a child or from a child to a parent. You can't skip that and go to a grandparent. It's just the way it was built. It's the way it was designed to encourage you to make sure that you don't skip levels in that hierarchy if you build a hierarchy of branches.
Right.
But that's not absolute. Like there's not a technical limitation there. It's a policy enforcement in TFVC. Okay. So
it did have a notion of doing what was called a baseless merge, didn't it? Where it could.
Yeah, and that's painful.
Without history. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, and basically yeah. So if you want to look at it from a merge perspective, what you're actually doing is doing a merge of two branches with no common literally no common ancestor. Mm. Think of it as an empty tree. And so if two files are different, they are in conflict, right? There's no common ancestor to try to figure out a three-way merge and do and figure out how you might resolve conflicts and do an auto merge. So yeah, it's incredibly painful.
Okay. So you just dropped in a couple of, you dropped in a couple of things there. So do you want to explain what a three-way merge is, first of all, and then, because that's kind of fundamental to understanding, and then just of a simple file, for example.
Right. So a three-way merge is the way in which all version control systems merge branches. So if you want to look at it just on a file level, imagine that you have some file, let's call it foo, in some branch, and then you create another branch and you modify that file foo. And in that original branch, you modify it in a different way. So now you've got three versions of this file, the common ancestor, and then the way it's changed in each of those branches. And if you want to integrate those, that's where the three-way merge comes in. And basically, you can think of it as going line by line in that file and looking at the common ancestor and both of the changes. And if a line is the same in all three, you haven't changed it in either branch, right? So we'll just copy that line into the result. Mm-hmm. Now, if that line is the same in the common ancestor and one of the branches, and it's changed in the other branch, then you've made a change in one of the branches that you want to carry that over. So we take the changed line into the end result, right?
Yeah.
And so as long as you've not changed any of the same line in both branches, then you can just, we'll call that an auto merge, right? We'll take the result. Any line you've changed in one side, we'll take it. Any line that's still in common, that's fine. It's when you've changed the same line in both branches that you have a conflict, and that's when you need to resolve it.
Okay.
And now this isn't perfect, right? Because it doesn't look at the semantics of the process.
It's exactly what I was going to ask now. Yeah. Is it always line by line? Is it?
It's actually, so I simplified it a little bit. Mm. Usually it actually coalesces things into chunks and kind of looks at regions of the file. But because if you change line 42 in one branch and line 43 in another, that might be close enough that you want to call that a conflict.
Right.
But it's not a guarantee, right? Because you could change a variable name, let's call it foo to bar or something in one branch. And then you could add a completely new line in a completely non-conflicting place that looks at variable foo in the other branch. And that would auto merge, but it wouldn't compile.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it depends on what language you're using. But so it's not perfect, but it's pretty good for most purposes.
And this also explains why merging of XML is so hard, because with XML, you've got semantic nodes. And so, you know, it doesn't really matter where a node is in a file, within an XML document sometimes. Positioning might not matter, but it does matter very much when it comes to the merge logic.
That's right. And there are semantic aware merge tools.
Wow. But beyond compare.
Yeah, I don't know about beyond compare. It may have some smarts. I haven't used it in a long time, but yeah, you can imagine an XML aware merge tool that instead of looking at lines, it looks at actual XML nodes.
Yeah, the
DOM
or whatever.
And then spits out some result. Yeah, exactly. And then there are some smart ones. The team that makes GMaster, the GMaster client.
That's awesome, by the way. Everybody should give it a try if they're using Git.
That's right. And one of their features is semantic merge.
Huh.
They have a semantic merge tool.
For which languages?
Well, so I know it uses Roslyn for C#, wow. But it's got a sort of pluggable model that anybody can contribute to. Hmm. And it's really crazy. Like, it can track function moves across files and stuff. So it's very smart. Wow. It's very, very clever.
Nice. Okay, so that's
nice.
That's a basic what happens when you do the merge and a simple merge, a three-way merge. So how does Git handle branching? Because one of the great things about Git is it's super lightweight branching model, and it's super easy to create new branches and relatively okay. Well, it's about the same pain to merge them, but it's really easy to create new branches and really easy to switch branches. So do you want to explain how that actually works?
Yeah, so the traditional branching model, which is, as you mentioned, a path space branching model, right? You've got a folder called main, trunk, or whatever you want to call it. And then you've got a folder named branches, and then you've got all your branches in there. So, you know, if I've got some project checked in, I've got like, you know, in TFEC, it's $/my project.
Yeah.
And then I've got $/project/trunk, and then I'll branch that trunk folder. And that sits inside my repository. So I've got all my branches, call it in path space, as you said. So Git does things differently. And most of the distributed version control tools also do this, which is they branch the entire repository. So if you have a Git repository, you've just got your code in it. You don't have like some branches folder or anything. You've just got your code. And when you want to create a new branch, you branch the entire repository at once. And so the way this works in Git is that if you're familiar with C pointers, you know, I hate to dig in on pointers, but I think that's the best way to visualize this. You have a branch that is just pointing at a node in your graph, in your history graph. Mm-hmm. So to create a new branch, it writes a new pointer. It's immediate. It doesn't have to copy files around like you might have to do in maybe CVS. It doesn't have to update any records in a database like you might have to do in a more modern centralized version control system. All it does is it writes, you know, one file that has that information about the commit ID that branch points to. So it's incredibly efficient. It's incredibly cheap.
And it doesn't need to mess with, because it's not copying files around in path space, it doesn't need to create a bunch of new files in your working copy on disk, because you're not changing it at this point. You're just saying, oh, by the way, I'm in a new branch now that forked from where I was over on master or something like that before.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, if you run git checkout -b, that's the way I you know, create a new branch and switch to it. It doesn't update the working folder at all.
Hmm.
And that's true even if you started making changes, right?
Yeah.
So if you can start hacking on something and maybe not even commit it, and then realize that you haven't created a branch yet. You're still on master and you shouldn't be, right? You want to check this into a branch. You can run git checkout -b right there. Again, doesn't touch the working directory. So all that data that you've either changed and you haven't staged, or that you have staged in the index, is all ready to go. So it won't affect master. It'll just affect the new branch.
See, I sometimes do this when I'm running into, if I'm running into an issue with, so I don't know if we're ready for this yet, but you say you're in master and you're working on something, and then you realize that, oh, I'm not up to date with my remote repositories master. And if I'm going to do all sorts of stuff at the minute, then then I would get into a lot of pain right now, because I would have to pull master down and do a merge, which we'll talk about that in a sec, but I'm going to get into some pain. And so quite often what I would do is I would go create a different branch, commit my stuff into that branch, and then go have master back to as close as it was at the remote repository, do the pull, like, you know, get the stuff down from the repository to my master, and then merge that stuff back in again so that I didn't like lose it. I knew where it was, kind of thing. I don't know if that's the right way of working. I just find that logical.
That's actually very similar to the way I work.
Okay. So this is, so let's, we're seeing how we, how, so the next thing we probably should cover then is Git's different from centralized version control tools in that you have multiple copies of repositories around. So if you are pulling, whenever you get your remote repository and you bring it locally, you're logically pulling from one branch, which is the master branch on Origin, and bringing it over to the master branch on your local repository. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So when you, yeah, when you do a, so when you do a pull, are you in effect doing, I'm going to say doing a merge logically from this remote repository into your local repository? Is that how you think of it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you are literally doing a merge or a rebase. Let's put a pin in that. So yeah, git pull in effect does a git fetch, which downloads the remote data, the remote branches into not the same named branches, but into branches that are on your repository. So you'll see like remote/origin/master. So that will be the master branch that is downloaded from the remote. And then you'll merge that into your master branch. Now, what I like to do is keep my master branch fully in sync with the remote. Like, I don't make any actual changes in my master branch.
Yeah.
So my master will always point to a commit in my origin master. It won't try to actually merge some of my data in. That's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, and that's definitely the safest way of working is what anybody who's sort of been around Git for a long time and worked with somebody else just knows not to mess with master kind of thing.
That's exactly right. So yeah, it merges. I mean, it literally runs git merge. And so ideally that's just a fast forward merge, which is a special.
Well, so thing. Yeah, let's explain this.
Actually, what we should do now maybe is take a break.
Yeah.
We'll pick this conversation about branching and merging up in the next episode, where we'll talk about some things that aren't really merges at all, like a fast forward and some other ways to integrate code like rebase and cherry pick. We hope you'll tune in again in 2 weeks. And until then, if you have questions for us, or if you have an idea for the show, get in touch. You can find us on Twitter. We're at @AllThingsGit. And thanks, Martin, for joining me to talk about branching and merging. And thank you for listening to another episode of All Things Git.